Members, we're going to call the meeting to order for the Housing Finance and Policy and Public Health Finance Division today. And it looks like we've got a full house. This is great. Welcome, everybody. We'd love to have this kind of connection from the community. It means a lot to us. And we've got a couple of bills today. The first one is Representative Hayden's bill on homeless programs, and then Representative Murphy's bill on support services for families with children who are deaf. And then we have a presentation from the State Council on Disability. So we have quite a bit to do today. When we have that kind of a schedule, we try to keep to a kind of a timeline. And I just talked with Representative Hayden, and I think we have about 35 minutes total for the first presentation of his bill. So if I'm dividing it up right with the people who have signed up to testify, it's about 5 minutes apiece, no more. And if you want us to have a chance to have questions, I think what we might do, Representative Hayden, if this works with you, is go through, have the testimony, and then have the questions. Would that be all right?
That's great.
Okay. And that way everybody will get heard who is on the schedule to be heard, and we'll just go ahead and get started. Welcome to your committee, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 1491 to
layover for possible inclusion.
Layover for possible inclusion for this.
In the honor of this bill.
Madam Chair, members, House File 1491, this bill appropriates money for the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, programs addressing long-term homelessness, transitional housing programs, and emergency service grants. The state's response system for Minnesota facing homelessness is facing major challenges. The first is increased demand for households who, due to the economic and foreclosure crisis, are needing access to shelters that don't have capacity. The second is the loss of funding that is keeping the response systems in place. Funding for the continuum of services to help newly and long-term homeless is being cut or even zeroed out in the governor's budget. For several years now, these programs have hung on through one-time funding, which has not been renewed for the upcoming biennium. This bill restores one-time funding, and it adds it to the base for emergency shelter grants, transitional housing, runaway and homeless youth, and long-term homeless service fund. All of these programs could use funds beyond this amount to serve our most vulnerable population. And there are proposals that we will be hearing that discuss the needs of each individually. This bill just sets the floor so Minnesota homelessness don't have the rug pulled from under them. With me today are advocates, providers, participants from each of these programs who speak to the necessity of keeping these funds in place.
Thank you. So you want to call your witnesses?
Sure. So our first testifier is Kit Hadley, who is the Executive Director of Heading Home Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee. Former Commissioner of our Minnesota Housing Finance Agency as well.
Madam Chair, I'm in the committee. It's good to see you again.
Yeah.
I'm Kit Hadley. I'm the Director of Heading Home Minnesota, which is a public-private campaign to end homelessness in the state. We work to bring private sector support to the success of state, county, and regional plans to end homelessness. And to do this, we work with business, faith, philanthropy, and others, and the coordinators of all the Heading Home plans. There are now 11 plans to end homelessness or long-term homelessness. The state plan was the first adopted. There are now 6 county plans, Anoka, Hennepin, Olmsted, Ramsey, Steele, and St. Louis, and 4 regional plans, Central, Southeast, Southwest, and Northwest. In the last 4 months, 3 new plans have been adopted, Northwest, Steele County, and Anoka County. The Olmsted County Board has heard evidence of the project to determine the costs of the 58 most frequent users of detox in the county. The cost is $2,000 a month per person in law enforcement, social services, detox courts, and the biggest bill of all, medical care. In St. Louis County, they have hired a discharge planner to try to deal with the discharge into homelessness from jails and other institutions, and trying to replicate the huge reduction in recidivism seen in Stearns County by a similar program that connected people leaving jails with supports and housing. In Hennepin County, there's been a unanimous vote to open 2 opportunity centers, one for youth, one for adults, to create a one-stop shop for homeless people. In Ramsey County, they have started their first systematic rapid rehousing program to get people as quickly out of shelter as possible, which has proven to reduce shelter costs over time. And in central Minnesota, the 14th of 14 county boards has voted to support their heading home plan. This campaign is part of a national movement that reforms our response to homelessness by shifting from a downward spiral of repetitive use of costly services to the positive results that come from stable housing and support. There are over 350 plans to end homelessness around the country, involving over 850 jurisdictions. This movement has been unusually bipartisan. It has engaged leaders from sectors not typically involved on this issue, and it has been based on real evidence that strategies that emerged in the mid and late 1990s actually work to end homelessness. Late last summer, we were poised to ask the 2009 legislature to complete the implementation of the state's business plan, including the goal of creating 4,000 new supportive housing opportunities by 2010. Over 2,500 new opportunities have been created to date, exceeding the goal each year of the last 5 years. But then the world fell apart, and we know that all these plans will take longer to implement, and that we need to think differently about how to proceed. So our goal is to preserve what we have accomplished to date and to not go backwards. We believe that we must complete this reform from unproductive spending to productive spending at some point in the future. The spending that occurs around the way we deal with homelessness now, for detox, policing, jails, courts, foster care, child welfare, emergency rooms, and hospitals, is no choice spending, where at the end of the day, no one, not homeless people and not taxpayers, are better off. Representative Hayden's bill, House File 1491, is really the floor for us to not go backwards and to position us so that we can complete this important work in the biennia ahead. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. That was very thorough. I hope you can stay around a little bit for questions if they come up. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Next, we have Kristen Anderson-Sembitz. Welcome to the committee. It looks like you have somebody with you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for hearing this very important bill. This morning, we want to speak on behalf of the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act funding, while also recognizing the rest of the bill and its significant importance to the community. As I hope that you've heard, there's growing concern throughout the state about the plight of young people who experience homelessness. And we are very pleased to see alliances being built statewide to look at prevention and intervention. Today we're here to talk about intervention. We absolutely must have a safety net for young people who experience homelessness. In other committees, in both bodies, we're talking this year about ways to improve our foster care system to ensure that youth who age out of care have the necessary support. But again, as Ms. Hadley represented, it is absolutely essential that we have that base floor available for young people who do experience homelessness. And we would like to applaud the decision made by this body in 2007 to make the targeted investment of $1 million in the Runaway to Homeless Youth Act. The evaluation that has been conducted thus far with 19 focus groups and other analysis has indicated that it has not been only targeted and effective, but it's also made a meaningful difference in the lives of young people. Young people themselves reporting that they have now meaningful connections with adults. They now have greater plans for their lives. And other significant notes include that they are less likely, as reported by themselves, to be inclined to participate in juvenile delinquency or behaviors that otherwise they would be inclined to do in the name of survival. So very wise decision on behalf of this body. The $1 million was able to serve 7,067 youth in 9 communities, all representing regional hubs around the state of Minnesota, particularly targeting communities in greater Minnesota, as you can see in the handouts that are before you. The funding also, though not as great as we'd be interested in, did do a very important act of helping to preserve funding and preserve programming across the state, especially in some of our greater Minnesota programs. and we still face the challenge of youth homelessness. Currently, while the research reports that on any given night in the state of Minnesota, there are over 1,800 young people who experience homelessness, and as you heard from Representative Hayden, the need continues. Every night, young people are turned away from shelter in communities across the state of Minnesota. With 65 shelter beds in the greater Twin Cities area and 44 shelter beds in greater Minnesota, we simply aren't meeting the need, and unfortunately turn young people away to seek to survive either with bus tokens through the night or with other means, house hopping and other alternatives that we wouldn't necessarily prescribe. Youth represent a unique group as we talk about homelessness. They are in crucial moments of development, and it is the targeted investment that this committee can make that helps youth emerge from crisis and, as you'll hear from Anthony, assure that they are on the path that they would desire for greater participation in community life and to become that fully participating adult that they would like to be. So we'd like to ask for your continued support for this important act, and with great pleasure I introduce Anthony Peterson.
Welcome to the committee, Anthony.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Anthony Peterson, and I'm here to talk to you about the services I received from places like The Bridge, Undie Young, and Youth Link. They are all organizations that have supported me as a young person, and I think that it is very important that there still be a way for these places to keep running and helping other young people. These services have supported me in many ways. These places have been a home away from home for me. As a young man, things have gone wrong in my life, and I found that I have nowhere to go. I didn't have much direction in life. I didn't really feel like I was going anywhere. So where can I go? I go to these places and have a place to stay. These places have given me shelter multiple times. They also help me connect with places to stay long term. And they have given me other resources such as school and figuring out what to do next in life. I was helped to obtain my GED, which helped me get into college. I've been accepted to college and will start attending this summer. These services have also led family meetings that helped me in my relationship with my parents. They have helped me to prioritize things in my life so that I can focus on things that are important that will help me to be successful. So with that being said, and now that you can see the help these services have provided me, I would like to thank you for allowing me to speak to you and share my experience and point of view. I would ask that you continue to support in whatever way you can the youth services in the state and Runaway and Homeless Youth Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony. Your story is very inspiring. I thank you for coming. How old are you?
17,
and you're accepted to college. Congratulations. I hope you can hang around. We're going to take questions at the end from all the witnesses, and so if both of you could come back, that would be great.
All right.
Thank you. Suwama Phillips.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I do have some handouts. If we could pass those out, please.
We'll get you some help in just a minute here. There we go.
Okay, my name is Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing. I'm also President and Owner of Integrated Community Solutions. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless and the National Coalition for the Homeless and MICA, the Metro Interface Council on Affordable Housing. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 1491. Elam Transitional Housing started out as a church-based shelter in the winter of 1982-83. Prior to that, I'd spent 8 to 9 years working with youth on the street and in shelters at St. Joe's and at other youth shelters before starting, and then volunteered at Simpson Shelter prior to starting a shelter at my church in 1982-83. From that experience and from our faith, we believed very strongly that we needed to move beyond shelter and provide an opportunity for people to have housing in the community and to reconnect with services within the community. And so we developed what's called transitional housing. It's a very simple idea. It's rapidly moving people out of shelter into housing with services, helping them stabilize in the community and move ahead. It was also utilized to prevent people from becoming housing. It became the model for our state legislation that was passed in 1984, the first state in the country to pass transitional housing legislation. It became the model for Hennepin County, being the first county in the country to utilize transitional housing as a way of preventing people from becoming homeless and rapidly moving people out of shelter into housing. It's very important as you look at this bill that Representative Hayden is bringing before you that we continue to maintain the funding that we have available to you. By now you've received a copy of our latest newsletter. I apologize that our Minnesota has two I's in it, if you've already noticed that. But I want to point out two people in this piece right here. The couple of folks that are on top there. Leo is now a housing discrimination attorney for the Legal Services Project. She came through our program when her parents were going through foreclosure when she was a teenager and she was living in Coon Rapids. Going through our program, stabilizing in housing, she's moved on in her life, has gone to college, has become an attorney, and is now helping other folks. The middle person is Daisy Barton. Both of them could not be here today, otherwise they'd be telling you their own story. Due to an economic downturn, she was not able to afford housing. We assisted with a rent subsidy, helped her stabilize, get into Section 8 housing. She eventually bought a home. She has now been working for Elam Transitional Housing for over 15 years, doing rapid rehousing here in Hennepin County. Carla is one of our board members, and 70 to 80% of our board are people that experience homelessness, as well as half of our staff. She experienced homelessness because of health issues. So there's a wide variety of reasons why people are experiencing homelessness. So it's important that we understand that just about any of us, if we get the right situation, lost a job, had a health issue, could experience homelessness. We are turning away still 1,000 people from shelter and transitional housing each night. Elam has been turning away about an average of 250 to 280 people a month over the last several months. Now, I know you have very difficult decisions to make in regards to the use of our tax dollars. As a person of faith, I think that we've been very blessed in this country to have resources and that we need to be sharing those with others and we need to treat others the way that we would want to be treated if we were in that same situation. But in the early part of this decade, in 2001, Elam decided to do some expansion into permanent supportive housing and developed a contract with HUD for 48 additional permanent supportive housing. After 9/11, a lot of our resources went down as we saw cuts in both the state and federal level. We decided to keep those contracts going, just like we're asking you to keep the services going right now. That meant we had to deal with a $150,000 deficit because we decided not to close those 48 units. We were able to deal with that. We were in deficit spending for a couple of years. We have been in positive cash flow over the last few years. So we know that this is a difficult decision, but this is a life and death issue for folks. We had 134 people die last year that we had a memorial service for. So it's very important that we recognize that if we do not have shelter, if we do not have transitional housing, we do not have housing, people will die. A couple other things just briefly that I would encourage you to look at as you're moving forward in this session is that the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless is supporting House File 2009, which would actually not only take the base funding that is talked about in 1491, the one-time funding and making it base funding, but actually increasing shelter by $500,000 and transitional housing by $500,000. We also encourage you to continue to look at how we can decrease the cost and supporting bills like the Homeless and Housing Coordination Bill and the HMIS bill. We are spending more money on data collection than we are on shelter in the state of Minnesota with the governor's proposed budget. Data is very important. You're going to get some great data from Heart Connection on the long-term homeless services. We need good data. But we cannot be spending more money collecting data about homeless people than sheltering people that are experiencing homelessness. And finally, and you've heard these couple things from me before last month, is that we need to really talk about how we can increase revenue. Many of us in this room own a home. the property tax and mortgage interest deduction will increase by almost $200 million that we're going to let folks in the state of Minnesota write off in the next biennium. We are encouraging you to cap it at the 2008 level, very similar to what the governor is doing on the appropriation side, collect that $200 million and use it to fund these programs as well as other necessary housing programs for people with limited resources. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Robin Phillips. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here. My name is Julie Mann Warren, and I'm the Executive Director for Simpson Housing Services. I recognize several of you from the tours of our shelter that were conducted last year, and I'd invite anyone who has not had that opportunity who would like to please come and we'll give you a personal tour. Our mission at Simpson Housing Services is to house, support, and advocate for people experiencing homelessness. We've been in the business of trying to keep people alive in basic shelter since the early 1980s when Simpson United Methodist Church opened its doors and allowed people to come inside and sleep on the floor. We continue to rent space at that location and to provide basic shelter. During 2008, in our men's and our women's shelters, we served 2,389 individuals. At our 20 mat, and I say mat rather than bed because that's what we have on the floor, at our 20 mat women's shelter, we had 283 individual adult women who came and found a safe place to sleep. At our men's shelter, 667 individual men were able to get a mat at our 40 bed per night men's shelter. 93% of those 667 were able to obtain permanent or transitional housing as a result of their stay with us. The annual cost to run the men's shelter, and that's not counting the food and 67% of the overnight staffing, which is provided by volunteers and members of the community who purchase, prepare, and serve the meals at each of our shelters every night. So the cost to run the shelter is just under $500,000 a year. Of that, 66% must be raised from the private sector. And that's a big part of my job. 34%, however, comes from federal, state, and county funds. And included in those public funds is $59,000 from the state of Minnesota. That $59,000 will be negatively affected if you do not pass this bill and reinstate the emergency services program. Over the past 3 years, we have seen an increase in individuals seeking services at our men's shelter and our women's shelter. We continue to turn away more people than we're able to serve. We applaud and participate in many of the efforts to move people out of the shelters and into housing. The new federal stimulus dollars may help with those efforts to keep people moving out of shelter and to reduce the flow of people into shelter. However, in the meantime, the emergency services program dollars are sorely needed to provide a floor for people to sleep on, literally, and minimal support so that they don't die outside. Please act affirmatively and approve House File 1491. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you very much, Ms. Minwan. I want to take a moment, as our other speakers are coming up, to welcome the 12th grade students from Princeton High School, and they're participating in the Minnesota Historical Society's Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government. You want to stand and be recognized, students from Princeton High School? Like to... Oh, you're all standing. Oh, please stand. Yeah. That's interesting. You're seeing a full house around an issue that a lot of people care about, so that you are left standing, and that's great. Okay, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jennifer Ho, the Executive Director of Parks Connection. The goal of all homeless programs is for people to live as independently as possible in their own home. Supportive housing is a critical part of the continuum of programs. Supportive housing is the alignment of support and housing targeted at people who need extra support to get and keep housing and who need a home as a foundation for addressing critical health, mental health, employment, and education needs. DHS's Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund is the state's vehicle to pay for services for people who need supportive housing to escape homelessness. This DHS service fund is complemented by housing investments made by Minnesota Housing, HUD, and others. Combined, they make supportive housing possible. Combined, they've helped thousands of people. DHS allocates this money to counties and Native American bands working together in regional partnerships. The funds go to 5 regional projects covering 6 tribal reservations and 36 counties. Today, these regional long-term homeless service projects support 33 formerly homeless youth, 823 formerly homeless single adults, and 937 formerly homeless families with 1,648 children. By definition, these are people with long histories of homelessness, many with little history of stability. 6 out of 10 adults in our program have had a problem with substance abuse. 7 of 10 have had a mental health problem, and over half have a physical disability. By definition, these people who need support in combination with their housing, they need it to remain in their home. Without support, these are people who have an extremely high likelihood of becoming homeless again. And I'd like to just pause for a moment if I could, because so many bothered to come today to give back through advocacy, people who were formerly homeless and now have homes of your own, and I want to thank you for coming from Rochester and Mankato and Owatonna and the metro area and around the state today. Thank you for your work. Long-term homeless service funding has always been a patchwork of one-time funding and base funding. To continue providing the support that keeps these men, women, and children in their homes, it costs $13 million. The governor's budget proposal of $9.8 to $2 million holds base funding harmless, but it does not restore one-time funding. House File 1491 would restore $3 million to the base to support current participants, help them stay in their homes, and continue their journeys of recovery. If you don't restore $3 million, it's a 24% cut in funding. Hearts Connection manages the 3 regional projects in the eastern part of the state. We've coordinated our efforts with projects in the northwest and in the southwest. We know 5 things with certainty. First, this service funding has made it possible for people with the longest histories of homelessness, sometimes decades, to come inside and have a home of their own. Second, this funding is critical for the unique services that someone needs to escape homelessness and to live a stable life in the community. Third, when someone who has been homeless for a long time has stable housing, they begin to do better. Most critically, people get access to life-saving health care, but also mental health support, support and recovery, and care for chronic health conditions. Children stop bouncing from school to school to school and go to the same bus stop every day. They have an opportunity to learn and to make friends. We believe we're reducing the likelihood that these children will become tomorrow's homeless youth, tomorrow's homeless parents, and tomorrow's homeless adults. Fourth, when people are homeless, it actually costs the government lots of money, but it's spent in the most costly settings with the least likelihood of producing a good result. And finally, when people have a home, they stop using all those high-cost crisis and institutional services and start taking better care of themselves, going to the doctor, taking medications, things that do produce results. I know that you don't have any new money. I know that you are working hard to stave off cuts to programs that serve the most vulnerable Minnesotans. I know that you are committed to helping people who are homeless. In this economy, at this time, it would be the worst time to make formerly homeless people homeless again. If you don't restore $3 million to the Long-Term Homeless Service Fund, 937 families who finally have a chance to settle down and take care of themselves, families with 1,648 kids who have been traumatized by the very experience of homelessness, 823 single adults with long histories outdoors and in shelters because they were sick and couldn't get the care that they needed, and 33 youth who so desperately need support at this critical time in their life will lose the level of support that's made it possible for them to break the cycle of homelessness. Without $3 million, we can't keep all the frontline staff that make these miracles happen one person at a time. This means 3,508 people will be at immediate risk to become homeless again. Before we started doing this work, families were living in vans, hiding in state parks. A woman I met recently lived in a tent in the woods for 7 years. A man in Bemidji was living in an oil can. An elderly man had been sleeping on church shelter floors for 12 years. A woman had been living under a bush in St. Paul. Today, 92% of Parks Connection participants are living in their own homes. 92%. Before we started doing this work, people who were homeless were incarcerated because they were mentally ill. People were put in jail because they didn't have a place to live. People had long hospital stays because they were very sick and didn't have a home to be discharged to. If we take away these services, the state will still spend the money as people return to emergency shelters, jails, prisons, emergency rooms, and hospitals. I'm asking you to support House File 1491 and find a way to restore $3 million to the Long-Term Homeless Service Fund. This work has been so transformational to the way that Minnesota responds to the problem of homelessness. These dollars are deeply valued in the Minnesota communities that have regional long-term homeless projects and sought after by communities that don't have a DHS grant. Staff at DHS see how we're accomplishing the goals of health care reform and mental health reform for the most vulnerable and alienated Minnesotans. Staff at the Department of Corrections see how we're accomplishing the goals of reentry and corrections reform. People across the country are asking us to teach them how to reach this group and achieve these results. If you can't help us fill this $3 million gap, the whole effort will go backwards. Now, with all the momentum to end homelessness around the state that Kit described, we need to be moving forward, not backwards. We can't abandon the most vulnerable Minnesotans right at the moment when they've begun to believe that something better is possible for them than the life they have been condemned to on the street. Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce Linda Buettner, who with her children was able to escape homelessness because of the support that they received from the Family Roots Alliance. That's a partnership between Lutheran Social Service and Simpson Housing that's paid for from the Long-Term Homeless Service Fund. After Ms. Buettner, Julie Grossman from Guild Incorporated, who manages a mobile service team helping long-term homeless single adults, would like an opportunity to describe how services paid for from the Long-Term Homeless Service Fund actually work. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Linda Buettner, and I would like to share my experience of working with Family Roots Alliance, which is funded by the State Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund. If it wasn't for the service that Family Roots Alliance provides for my family and I, wouldn't be where we are today. I grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota, and now live in Minneapolis. I have three children, two boys and one girl. Before I became involved with Family Roots Alliance, I had been homeless for 9 years out of 13. I was able to get various apartments but would lose them after about 3 weeks because I wouldn't pay the next month's rent. My kids were bounced from school to school and I didn't have any stability. I was chemically dependent with drug of choice of being crack cocaine. I was addicted for 10 years and thought that because I never did drugs in front of my children, they didn't know about my addiction. Turns out they knew the whole entire time. Mm-hmm. I've been in denial for a long time. I was more focused on partying than being a parent. In December of 2005, I was arrested and spent a little over 3 months in jail. During this time, my boys were staying with my brother Ron, and my daughter was put in foster care. After my jail time, I went to chemical dependency treatment and then stayed with a friend. I entered a halfway house but left early to stay with my sister. I lived with my sister for a short time and then left to go to a shelter in Minneapolis. My sister's lease was being jeopardized by my staying there. It took me a while to realize that the only way I could get help was to reach out for help and work on myself. I didn't want to stoop so low as thought them to have to stay in a shelter, but I had no choice. I took one of my sons with me. The other son stayed with my brother, and my daughter was still in foster care. Being homeless is scary. My son and I almost didn't make it to the shelter by clothes one night and almost had to spend the night outside. My son was 10 at the time and was very afraid. It's hard to put a child through that. In January of 07, I was referred to Family Rest Alliance. They helped me find an apartment in less than 2 weeks. My son had been with me in the shelter, lived there right away and my other son was able to come home by the end of the month. My daughter was still in foster care, and she was able to come home in June of 07. The judge was amazed of everything I accomplished in less than 6 months. Accomplishments that I couldn't have done without the support of Family Rest Alliance program. Making changes in your life is hard work. They support me, but I was the one who had to change. The staff provides support for me and my kids. They don't just put us in housing and forget about us. Travis, my educational supportive advocate, was able to find schools that were good to fit my kids. My advocate helps out with bus fares for school and with school supplies. My kids now have more one-on-one time with their teachers and are learning to control their emotions. Family Rest Alliance also has teen groups and put on different activities that my kids look forward to. They help my family to be adopted so that we can get assistance for Christmas gifts. Today I have been sober for over 3 years. I can talk about it with my kids now, but it's hard to transition. My kids weren't used to a sober mom and had to get used to the adjustment. The advocates at Family Rest Alliance are helping with my parenting skills and with helping my kids learn responsibility. When I was using, I would give my kids whatever they wanted. I didn't know how to manage my priorities and responsibilities, and therefore definitely didn't have a way to teach my kids about responsibility. My family advocate, Lee, helped me come with a system to help me and my kids with budget. I want to get to the point where I help homeless people that are in the situation I used to be in. I want to let folks know that it's hard to be homeless, but help is out there. Don't be ashamed to ask. I look forward to opening the blinds every morning. I love my new life. When I was addicted and homeless, I didn't realize my responsibilities. Now, with the help of my advocate, I do. I don't want my kids to make the same mistakes I did. There have been times in my life, even while in this program, that I was ready to give up. If it wasn't for the Family Rest Alliance staff, I wouldn't be where I am today. I always try to find a way to work out issues on my own first, but I know that my advocates are only a phone call away. My testimony today isn't just for myself. It's for everybody else out there who needs a hand up. I hope that my story will help bring about opportunities for others who were in my situation to turn their lives around too. Thank you for listening and for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Kushner. I appreciate your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Julie Grothy, and I am the supervisor for Delancey Street, which is a program of Guild Incorporated, which is funded through the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund. I am not homeless, nor have I ever been homeless. I have not ever had to worry about where I'm going to sleep tonight or what I'd have to do in order to have a bed to sleep on tonight. But I can tell you that everyone enrolled in our program has had to deal with that issue and many more challenges. What I've learned about homelessness has been from the people enrolled in our program. For many, their journeys began when they were young. They grew up in families that were chaotic, abusive, and often led to placement in institutional settings. Some grew up in middle-class families, and their difficulties began when mental health issues, legal or financial troubles started. Others have had addiction issues, which chip away at the structure, health, and disability of their lives. But they all ended up falling through the cracks of our society's security net. After years and years of homelessness, many had lost any hope of ever getting back on their feet and living a normal life with housing and a job and a support system. They had lost trust in society. And a sense of hope is critical to recovery. When we started our project, we found the perfect name in Delancey Street, which is, by the way, an actual street in New York City.
In the 1800s, Delancey Street was a place where immigrants landed and often ended up homeless. But it became known, however, as an oasis of hope for many because of the services that were available to people who needed them. For our participants, the first goal towards that oasis of hope is stable housing. Sometimes people imagine that finding housing for somebody without a rental history, without a credit history, and who might have many strikes against them in the landlord's eyes, well, people imagine this is the hardest part. While finding housing can be challenging, we found that once this happens, the really hard work begins. With a stable base, we can begin to address all the issues that impact the lives of our participants, their health, their financial situation, their ability to access community resources, and their opportunities to give back and find meaning to volunteering and employment. After housing, we address financial stability. Initially, this means getting people on general assistance, food stamps, medical coverage. Sometimes this means employment. Our staff engages participants by building rapport and gaining trust. With medical coverage, we start exploring physical and mental health issues that impact our participants' lives. Often, this is the first time that these issues have been addressed for them. Many participants discover undiagnosed mental health issues. Our staff helps them by educating them about living with these disabilities. Once these issues are identified, which often contributed to or exacerbated their homelessness, we begin accessing community resources and setting up a routine to help maximize each individual's potential. For example, we help them schedule and obtain transportation to doctors and dental appointments. We help them take medications, do weekly grocery shopping, budgeting, paying the bills on time, and sometimes cleaning apartments. All those normal things that we all do from day to day. As people progress, we have participants realize that they can sever ties with bad relationships, or they can work and actually regain custody of their children. They find out they can get a job and keep it with support, or they can go back to school for that GED. For others, their disability is severe enough that they're eligible for Social Security benefits. Once a certain level of stability is achieved, many participants begin to reconnect with past relationships and loved ones. They no longer feel ashamed of who they are and where they are in life. Most importantly, participants begin to develop the pervasive, unobtrusive, and sustainable support that every person needs. Casual supporters like friends and family, and appropriate professionals that everybody needs to call on from time to time. Now it's easy for me to lay out the steps needed for participants to be successful. In reality, the process is far more complex and challenging. It's a process to learn and relearn what it takes to keep housing. On this journey, people are often homeless again, engaged and re-engaged, and we try to keep the process moving forward. It takes persistence to see what works and what doesn't work for an individual. We are teaching people to change their entire life and to shift their thinking and to develop the toolkit that homelessness just doesn't teach you, how to find and keep housing and to do so while being a good neighbor and giving back to your community. One of my colleagues said it best. I had to throw out almost everything I knew about traditional case management out the window. The critical point is that homelessness is no longer an intractable problem that we just simply have to live with. It's one of the few social problems we actually know how to solve, and we are solving it, person by person by person. I've seen it happen again and again. Please, support this bill so that we can continue this vital work for all of us and for our communities. I thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you very much. I think Representative Hayden, that's the list of your... Now, if there are any committee members who want to ask questions of any of you, I think you have before you the list of everybody who's testified today. We could start with the last group if anybody has any questions. I just have one that I think you talked about the cost savings. And I'm just wondering... one of the problems in the legislature, of course, is we have different appropriations and different committees. And I'm wondering if you have, tried to say what to invest in this particular arena would save us in Health and Human Services, for example, hospitalizations. You talk about corrections. Any document that's been prepared that actually traces some of that back so that we could use that in our discussions?
Madam Chair, Heart Connection has been working in partnership with state government for the last 7 years to document exactly that. What are the costs of homelessness in our system, and how do these big shifts that we see in where people get care out of prisons and into services in their homes, how does that impact state budgeting? The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation was an enormous contributor in this, and they are helping us release that document. It actually should be available publicly in the next week or two, and we certainly want it available for your deliberations. It will be out very soon, I promise.
If we could get a preliminary copy or...
The one thing that I would point out, having had an opportunity to preview this, is that it is exactly the way your structure is set up that keeps us from being able to cap the savings that we realize right away. The savings that we have in the correction system don't get reinvested into services. The savings that we have when people don't go to the emergency room don't get reinvested in community-based support. And we're also seeing a dramatic shift away from programs that were 100% state-funded, like general assistance or general assistance medical care, onto programs where there's a significant federal contribution, like SSI or Medicare or Medicaid. So there are lots of different places. We're working really closely with the Department of Human Services, George Hoffman, who does the forecasting there, to try to understand if there's anything in that data that's applicable to your process. But frankly, I think your process is short-sighted, if you'll forgive me for saying so. In a world where if somebody's been homeless for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, they're not going to get better in the first 2 years. It takes longer. Yet we know that in the long run, that we're going to be spending money more wisely and not spending money in places where we're not getting outcomes. We will make that information available to you as soon as it's ready.
Thank you so much. Committee members, do you have questions or comments? It's a pretty powerful testimony from the witnesses, Representative Hayden. Very thoughtful.
Madam Chair, if I may. In closing, I just wanted I think I can't overstate the impact that this program has had on participants who have experienced long-term homeless. I want us to understand the population that we're talking about. I don't know if we said it. The state's definition of long-term homeless is 4 times in the last 3 years of being homeless are 1 continuous year. So that is folks that have been homeless for a very long time. On the long-term homeless side, and then on the emergency and transitional housing, the great work that we're doing to try to prevent people from being homeless or rapidly getting them out. I have personally worked with about half the advocates in this room. I just want them to know that they have transformed the way that I look at homelessness in terms of the work that they're doing. And so I just want to kind of personally, if I may, say thank you to the work that they do, and they do it even though we fund them at $13 million today. They really are doing about double the amount of work that they should be doing, and I just want them to know that, and know that traveling throughout the state of Minnesota in the last 3 years working with some of these advocates, I just want them to know how great their work is. And in closing, we through this initiative are allowing people and their families to take back their lives and get in control of their lives so that they can be prosperous. Thank you.
Thank you very much. One thing that comes to mind that I might ask as well from some of the other people who testified too would be, this is a very modest bill in many ways. It's restoring a base funding. I think you called it earlier, I think Ms. Abbey talked about it as the floor for what is needed, and maybe you talked about that. I'm thinking it would be really helpful for this committee, and as we discuss with others in the legislature, to have the actual comparison of what's in this bill as compared to what the need is. And for example, I know with homeless youth, there's $1 million ask here. I think when we had this bill before us 2 years ago, I think the need was $8 million, something like that, $6 or $8 million, and I think we were able only to fund that much. And I would guess if it would be, I would ask if it would be possible just for an update, a document maybe that could be prepared for us to carry around and remind ourselves of what the need is in each of these areas as compared to what we're actually hearing here today. Not that we're promising that we have any of this money, but I think that it's important for us to know just what the need is.
Madam Chair, if I may, the need for the long-term homeless, to eradicate it, to end long-term homeless in this state, has been estimated at about $42 million. That would be the amount that we think that we could essentially make long-term homeless statistically insignificant. I know that there's $8 million for the Runaway Youth and Homeless Act, and I'm not sure, do we know the number? Sue, do we know the number for it?
Just very briefly, please.
Madam Chair, Sue Watlow Phillips. For transitional housing and shelter, what the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless has is $14 million is the need for those programs. Again, House File 2009 would increase resources by $500,000 for shelter and transitional housing above this bill, putting the one-time dollars back into the base budget. Obviously, we're talking about incredible costs to shelter people, so keeping people in housing and stabilizing people is very important. In Hennepin County, for a family, the adult, it costs $36.47 a day to have them in shelter. For a child, it's $26.71 a day to have them in shelter. For a single person to be in shelter, it's $32.63 a day. Now, we know that both transitional housing and long-term homeless services funding housing is much less expensive, gets people back into housing, provides those services for folks in the community. Doesn't mean that we don't need shelter. We definitely need shelter to help people's immediate needs. But we need to prevent people from going into shelter, and we need to get people back into housing as rapidly as possible.
Okay, thank
you. Madam Chair, if I may.
Briefly.
Very briefly. Okay. The Runaway Homeless Youth Act 2 years ago is $8 million, and I believe that will be carried again as an $8 million bill. And then also, to add to what Representative Hayden said about the Long-Term Homeless Service Fund, Representative Thiessen will be carrying a bill that adds $42 million to the base. That actually only funds the amount of supportive housing that the state has invested in to date. I believe that Kit Hadley talked about 2,600 units. If we were to go the final step, and really end all long-term homelessness, the estimate is that you would need to add $74 million to the long-term homeless service fund. But based on some preliminary math that we've been playing with, you're spending about $72 million a year on people being homeless in these crisis and institutional settings. So use that as a point of reference for what does it mean to add $74 million.
Thank you. That's just exactly what I was asking for
earlier. And we'll put that together for you.
Thank you so much. Unless there's any other questions, we should probably move on. Committee members, this is very compelling testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
And
it.
All the people who came today to help us understand this situation. Senator Murphy is here for her bill. Here she comes.
We're talking about you. You've got your card.
Yes.
We
can meet with you. We'll do that.
Okay, welcome to the committee. I'm just asking people to be a little bit quiet as you're leaving. We've got two more presentations today. Thank you very much, everybody. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Lane, did you want to move this bill? Representative Lane moves that House File 1819 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and it's a privilege to be here once more before the committee, and it is clear after listening to the compelling testimony of the last piece of legislation that we are at the place in the session where we are confronting difficult choices.
Excuse me just a second. Mr. Could I ask you to take your discussions outside? I know they're very important, but we need to be able to move forward with the other bills. Thank you so much. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to introduce House File 1819 on behalf of Life Track Resources and the many parents and children have been served by the Minnesota Hands and Voices Parent Guide Network. This is a piece of legislation I worked on 2 years ago, and I'm really glad to be back before the committee to talk with you about it once again. Life Track Resources is a longstanding nonprofit agency here in St. Paul, and their mission is to build better lives by working together to develop people's strengths. Life Track Resources administers the Hands and Voices Parent Guides Network, which provides family-to-family support services to families across Minnesota who have a child who is deaf or hard of hearing. Hi, how are you? Originally started as a program for families in the metro area, the Parent Guide program was expanded in 2006 to have a parent guide in every region of Minnesota. New research shows that if we find these children and get them into programming by the age of 6 months, children's language skills are the same as their peers by age five. The parent guide provides parents with individual support, access to information, and connection to local parents to help them make crucial decisions in a timely manner, early intervention. In 2007, the Parent Guides Network received $199,000 of general fund dollars for 2 years on a one-time basis. And as we all know, and as we are confronting the difficult choices of the budget we face, we know the state can't afford the general fund appropriation to continue this program. But we don't want to lose the progress that we have made. And therefore, House File 1819 proposes to increase the current hospital blood clot fee from $101 to $105 to pay for this program. House File 1819 also builds the Parent Guides Network into the current statute governing early hearing detection and intervention. To provide further details about the program, I'd like to introduce Candace Lindahl Davies, a parent of a child who is deaf and the Family Support Connection Coordinator of Life Track Resources. Candace is an expert on this issue, and I'm really glad that she's with me today. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Davies.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Murphy, and thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Candace Lindahl Davies, and I am the proud mother of a now 13-year-old son who is profoundly deaf. Also very privileged to be the coordinator of Minnesota Hands and Voices at Life Track Resources. We are a parent-to-parent support network for Minnesota families who have children who are deaf and hard of hearing. And today I do ask for your support for a $4 increase in the blood spot fee to continue our program. As Representative Murphy mentioned, Hands and Voices started at Life Track Resources in 2000, primarily as a metro service through funding through the Greater Twin Cities United Way. For the past 7 years, the Minnesota Department of Health charged with the task of implementing universal newborn hearing screening and an early hearing detection and intervention system has contracted with Life Track Resources to provide parent-to-parent support throughout the state. In response, Minnesota Hands and Voices built a network of trained parent guides in each of 7 regions, offering parents local support and connections to community resources. In 2008, the Department of Health entrusted Minnesota Hands and Voices parent guides with the responsibility of calling families with newly diagnosed children on behalf of the Department of Health. Harnessing the passion and experience of parents who have themselves navigated the system to ensure new families are emotionally supported, encouraged to return for the necessary follow-up healthcare appointments, and are linked with early intervention has been an overwhelming success. This has also meant a 39% increase in the families and professionals served by Minnesota Hands and Voices, and a 54% increase in families connected to parent-to-parent support, which is a national goal. Minnesota Hands and Voices helped 929 unduplicated families and professionals in 2008 with just over 2.5 FTEs available. As you may know, in 2007, community stakeholders came before this legislature to pass a mandate to screen every newborn for hearing loss, funded by an increase to the blood spot fee. In the same year, Minnesota Hands and Voices also came before you and received an allocation from the general fund, which ends this June. Although Minnesota Department of Health has given us temporary financial support until June of 2010, their current level of funding cannot sustain us. We are certainly sensitive to our state's current financial crisis. We are respectfully asking Minnesota Hands and Voices be included in the blood spot fee to ensure consistency throughout the state and protect the safety net we have built to ensure that every child with hearing loss gets appropriate services and support. While corporate and foundation grants have helped support this project, consistency and continuation of the program requires a public investment. The cost savings and reduced special education of identifying and intervening with one child with bilateral deafness, according to the CDC, is $4,500 per year. Over the course of a child's education, intervening with only a handful of kids would cover the full cost of Minnesota Hands and Voices for 1 year. We ask your investment in the future of our children who are deaf and hard of hearing, and I invite you to listen to One Parent's Experience. I'd like to introduce Laura Libby and her son Blake, who has joined us today.
Thank you. I guess we've already heard a little bit from Blake, so
yeah.
Now I hear from Blake's mama. Welcome
Hi.
To the committee.
Well, we were shocked when we found out he was born deaf. It's overwhelming enough to have...
Excuse me, could you just introduce yourself so we have it on the tape?
I'm sorry. I'm Laura Libby. This is my son, Blake Libby. He's 16 months old. And he was found to be deaf through the newborn hearing screening, and that was definitely a shock to us. He's my first child, and it was overwhelming enough just having a child. But to find out that our child was deaf, I just never had known anyone deaf before. None of my other friends had ever had deaf children. We didn't know who to turn to or what to do. All of a sudden, we're in an audiologist's office, and they're handing you tons of stuff, school districts, and one of the things they hand you, you got to go see all these doctors, you're going to go see ENT, you're going to have the school district coming in, and then they hand you the thing for LifeTrack Resources, too, and everybody, of course, you know, you have to go and do all these things, but calling LifeTrack Resources was so wonderful because they were actually other parents that you could talk to who had gone through these. And talking to a doctor is, I mean, it's great to go to doctors, but it's not the same as being able to call a parent and hear what they've gone through. And they were able to connect you to other parents who could tell you what they've been through. And I remember feeling so scared, actually I'm still so scared, of what did this mean for my child. He was born with 1 year moderate to severely deaf and 1 year severely to profound deaf. And we knew that he couldn't hear speech with those levels. We knew they were saying they were going to fit him with hearing aids. But I believed at that point that that meant he really wouldn't learn to speak. And to be able to be connected with the parent guide who was there for me to talk about any issues that I needed to talk about, to know that her child had similar diagnoses, couldn't hear speech without hearing aids, and he'd learned to speak. I was able to meet her son. I was able to meet other people and their children and hear about cochlear implants. I never had even heard of that. I didn't know how the technology was for hearing aids, and it made me have a hope that I don't think I would have had. You feel so hopeless at the time that what am I going to do? How do I know how to raise a deaf child? It's daunting enough to raise a child and to have to go through these things that you've never had experience with. It just was very comforting at any time when you wanted to talk to somebody or to know and feel that everything's going to be okay. And that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be problems that arise, because that's been another amazing part of all of this is how many things change and how many things come up. And I don't know what the next thing is going to be, but already for us, there's things that doctors will, specialists will want you to go and see. And we were referred at one point from a doctor to go get genetic testing, and my husband and I were really scared to go and do it, and we had decided that maybe we were going to not do it, that we thought it was kind of invasive, and we didn't know why it was necessary, and I don't think the doctor made it very clear to us why it would be necessary. And there was one point we were reading the Hands and Voices newsletters, and there was an article in there about a research study being done at the University of Minnesota for the relation of deafness with cytomegalovirus, and I decided to take part in that because I felt that that could maybe help other people, and I had been starting to think more about genetic testing, and through meeting that researcher, and then I was talking with my parent guide more, I decided to go fully ahead and get genetic testing done for my son, and in doing that, they got us connected with people at the University of Minnesota Lions Children's Hearing Center, and he's now a cochlear implant candidate. And if we hadn't gotten at that point
in where they were starting to tell us, well, maybe you should meet these audiologists here and maybe you should look at that. And he was found in the CT scan that they did for the genetic testing to have a something called Mondini syndrome, which means his cochlea only don't go around the full 2.5 turns that all of us are born with, so it means he has underdeveloped cochlea. And we were told when that was found that that is related to progressive hearing loss. We couldn't be told if that would mean his hearing would deteriorate more in 3 months or 2 years or 10 years. But then we knew that that was going to be happening, and we also decided then we'll see the audiologist at the U. And right when we did that, it was amazing because his hearing started dropping right away. Mm-hmm. And if we weren't in there already, because you already have to have a relationship with the audiologist at the Lyons Children's Hearing Center for a certain amount of time and a certain amount of visits to become the candidate, and we were seeing an audiologist at Children's West before that, and the fact that we had had that started when these drops were being detected, and then they could make him a cochlear implant candidate, and he's going to be scheduled to be getting the surgery this summer, we would already be missing out, and maybe we would be, I don't know, 3 months behind if it got detected at Children's West. But to think that even 3 months or 6 months behind in this critical period of speech is amazing to me, and it was all because I read that article in Hands and Voices newsletter that got me thinking, well, maybe I should do this, that would be a good thing. When then I was thinking about the genetic testing, and we just got connected with the right people that I just wasn't thinking was that important at that time, and it turned out to be really critical for our family that we had done that. And I mean, he is behind on his speech. When we've seen speech therapists now, compared to normal hearing children, his speech spoken language level is at about the same as a six-month-old, so we know he's going to be making vast improvements when he can get that cochlear implant in. And just being able to have people to talk about, or when you're not thinking straight, or you're just thinking, oh, I'm scared of this, I'm scared of genetic testing, I'm scared people are going to put him in a CT scan, and to have other parents say, I went through it, it's not that scary, these things are important to do. The other thing was, we found, not conclusively because their genetic tests unfortunately aren't advanced enough, but he may have something called Pendred syndrome as well, which is related to deafness. And Pendred syndrome is related to a thyroid condition that can come up later in life, and again, they don't know exactly when. He could have elevated thyroid levels in 6 months. He could have elevated thyroid levels when he's a teenager. If elevated thyroid levels were to come up with him earlier in life, that is related to causing him to not fully develop his brain function, and he could be delayed for the rest of his life in his brain capacity if he were to have elevated thyroid levels and we weren't checking for it. Now we're working with an endocrinologist who has him on a plan that every 4 to 6 months we're going to be testing his thyroid levels indefinitely because he's at a high risk for developing these abnormal thyroid levels, and we want to catch that before anything detrimental would happen, because he could go on medication and then nothing bad would happen to him. It's also been wonderful for us to have Hands and Voices, because just the amount of different educational styles and educational materials is overwhelming, and that's been a lot of stuff to learn as well. And I was not aware at all about even the amount of controversy within the deaf community and the hearing community, and using sign language and using auditory oral techniques and auditory verbal techniques. And people are really set in the ways they believe in these things, and they believe that one way only will work on either side. And Hands and Voices has been a wonderful place where you can kind of talk about your views, and they're open to however people want to pursue what they want to pursue. So if you want to pursue sign language, they're open and they'll help you get resources for that. If you want to pursue auditory oral, they're open and they'll help you find resources for that, and they'll talk with you about whichever way, non-judgmentally. And that's been great, because even me and my husband, we didn't think, being hearing people, that we would experience that. But we actually, even with some of the doctors at the U, were amazed at how much some people's biases come through on them telling us how they felt that some of the things that we were doing with him were wrong, and that really kind of offended us. But to know that that's out there, and to have people to talk to about that, that's normal, that's just somebody's viewpoint. And my friends and my family, if I try to call them about all this and tell them that all this stuff is going on, they'll listen to me, but they don't understand the full extent, and to have other parents that can tell me what they've been through also, that actually have real advice, real places that I can call, and that have helped us immensely, like that we're here now being a candidate for cochlear implant. My family, my friends wouldn't have been able to say that to me. They didn't know these things. They don't know anything about the controversies in the deaf community. And sometimes it's just good to have these people to call just because you're so frustrated and overwhelmed and you need someone to listen to you and you're just at your wit's end, and to know that you're normal, that everything's going to be okay. And also recently, I can't believe how much work there is involved with the school district, and I've been calling Hands and Voices and my parent guide recently because I've been having problems with the annual IEP, and they've gotten me in touch with PACER, which has been so wonderful to have that advocate. But I, even though the school district's handing me information, PACER's name is on everything, it's amazing because you get so much information that as a parent you're not thinking, oh, I should call PACER, that's who's going to help me. But I was explaining my situation to my parent guide, and she's like, I think the best thing for you would be to call PACER, and they are helping me so much. I don't even want to imagine what it would be like if I didn't have PACER working with me right now, and that would not have happened if my parent guide did not say that to me. I just didn't think about it. So,
Ms. Vivian, you have given us great testimony.
I could keep going, and I just...
You've done a great job.
Perfect
job. And I want
to
just find out if we can wrap it up a little bit. There's one other witness I believe you wanted to call. Is that right? But before you go, I did want to ask Ms. Davies a quick question. It sounds like you work with the health department.
Yes.
And does the health department provide training for parent guides to then contact the families? Is there a training part of this?
We're a contractor with them. We have a national organization, National Hands and Voices, and we work in compliance with their training that they would recommend for parent guides to be unbiased and to work with families in the sensitive types of situations. So we subscribe to that. We do work with health departments, and we go through MAIS training, which is a funding-based training. So we do some things in collaboration with the health department. We're part of their system. So when there's training going on for professionals, we get back in that way.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that, there is Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, LifeTrack is one provider. Are there others throughout the state that help outside, do you provide for outstate? I see you're nodding.
Yep. We expanded to Greater Minnesota several years ago, 2006, and so we do have trained parent guides in each one of seven regions, the metro being one, but then six outlying regions. So they are a local support to families in those areas. Yeah, so we are outstate as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm
also wondering, and I don't know if the parent would prefer to answer, but the special ed services through the school districts, are they providing a lot of the speech therapy or what other kinds of services to the child?
Let me answer, and then you can come in too. There certainly is a lot. There are a lot of services. I call them the cavalry. They come to your door with all a variety of special education services. There are also private services that can be obtained, and that's something that sometimes our families need guidance with as well, that there are other community resources out there that can play a role in conjunction with the educational services that are there. So, yes, it is there.
We're going to have to wrap up. We have one person who can't come back tomorrow for our next presentation, so if we could just have a quick comment, that would be great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartnett, and I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. We're a small state agency that advocates for and with people who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing, and try to advance equal opportunity for children and adults who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing. I'm here to testify in support of House File 1819 and to thank Representative Murphy for yet again coming before us with a great piece of legislation. You've heard fabulous testimony. 2 years ago, we approached the legislature because we were in the bottom five of states, according to the CCEC, in our identification of babies with hearing loss. We did not have a mandate, and we got five pieces of legislation passed. All of those pieces of legislation are in the base except for this. What has happened in 2 years? In 2 years, we've gone from being in the bottom five of our identification of babies with hearing loss to identifying and screening close to 96% of all babies. and having the laws to follow up of parents who are following through to get confirmation of that hearing loss at less than 4%. The national average is 50%. Mm-hmm. The Department of Health has done a fabulous job. What happens after those babies are identified? The first phone call is these people. And for them to get connected with IFSPs, to get the early childhood intervention services, the medical services provided in an unbiased manner is essential. We need to go from it being basically one-time funding to see if it works, to having it incorporated into the infrastructure of the service delivery system. Representative McFarland, you asked about, Madam Chair, you asked about the standardized curriculum. This last 2 weeks ago in Dallas, Hands and Voices National won the national award from the CDC, from the National Center for Hearing Assessment and Management, for a national award on their provision and their advocacy and their effectiveness in these services. They're recognized by the CDC and the National Center for Hearing Assessment and Management. Their services are unparalleled, are recognized on a national level. And again, we need to go from one-time funding to having it be part of the infrastructure and delivery system. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your testimony. So, thank you, and we'll move on to our final presentation. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Did you want to say anything else?
Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Lane renews her motion that the House File 1819 be laid over for possible consideration on the bill. I was just thinking, Representative Murphy, we almost have a Representative Murphy omnibus bill. We've got two bills from you. You're doing a good job this year. Okay. The last person is from the State Council on Disability, Joan Wilshire. And members, I'm going to ask your indulgence if you can stay maybe an extra 5 minutes. We've had some great testimony today. We're running a little short on time. If you'd be willing to do that, I'd like to give Ms. Wilshire the opportunity to present the information from the State Council on Disability, which we haven't had a chance to hear yet.
Good morning.
Hi, welcome back. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. Good morning. I'm Joan Wilshire, Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability. So sometimes that's a gift to talk fast, and sometimes it's not. But I know when the stomach is growling, that we have to listen to that. Anyway, thanks so much for having us in this morning and accommodating some of my issues here and so forth here. The Council on Disability, we've been around for over 35 years. In fact, this last year we just celebrated our 35th anniversary. And one of the things that we do is we work with not only the governors, state legislature, you folks, state agencies, and the public regarding disability issues. We're also one of the 5 state councils that exist in terms of being a statewide disability resource for all of you folks. We have just a little over 7 staff, 2 interns from the Humphrey Institute, and a 15-member governor-appointed council. This is down from the 21 statutory members that we can have. Our budget is a little over, currently it's at $524,000 a year, and with the current recommendation on budget cut of 5%, it'll be reduced to $498,000 per year. So what I want to talk to you a little bit about is just briefly some of the things you do, and then how this 5% budget will impact the council and our community of people with disabilities. In 2008, we really nearly doubled our contacts, and that was through our telephone, email inquiries, going to conferences, education inquiries, and so forth. And what that means is generally in a given year, we can get between 10 and 14,000 worth of contacts, calls, emails, and so forth. And this last year, you know, and thank goodness also to our new reporting system through our software package, we actually looked like we came close to 24,000. So, and we still have the same staff, less money, and so the good news is you're getting one heck of a bang for your buck here if you're looking at what are you getting for the dollars that you are throwing our way as an agency. And so that's the good news here. In the rough outline here, what are we doing with our funds and so forth? One of the biggest things we do is reviewing disability policies, such as building codes, architectural drawings, and workers' comp. That's another area we've doubled in the last couple of years, and that I think that speaks to the good things we're doing when people do get injured in the, that work for the state. So that usually, workers' comp has gone from about 12 cases a year to, I believe last year we were close to 40. And I know this year, just in January and February, if we continue at this rate, we'll be on what we did last year. and that is we have one person in our office who does that. And they, you don't even want to know what involves with that. It's a long Sunday afternoon and a Saturday afternoon that involves doing, putting those plans together for someone to be able to come up with a workers' comp plan. We work with collaborative and coordinated interagency disability efforts. We get calls from a variety of state agencies that can you come sit in this committee, can you come do this? And you try to send somebody somehow. We provide information referral, technical assistance on disability parking. That's our probably second biggest thing beyond building code. And that we work in conjunction with the Department of Public Safety. Again, with no added funds, but people think we are the people that actually deny or approve a disability parking placard. That we do not. The Department of Public Safety gets to do those yay and nays. We don't get that. We just get the calls of the complaints. And then we work with people trying to figure out how we can get make sure they it's valid and that they are using the placard in a legal way and so forth and getting education out on that. Also, developing customized training regarding ADA, and probably our newest topic is emergency preparation. As we speak last week, with the flooding going on up in the Red River Valley, my staff person, again, one person does this, worked with the Centers for Independent Living, the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Public Health, regarding the flooding, because people with disabilities are going to be impacted up there. We have to make sure shelters are secure and accessible, and that they don't separate people's guide dogs, hearing dogs, etc., with their partners. And so this is a big deal. And so we've been doing a lot of makes it work with that, as well as along with our other issues. So, you know, emergencies never seem to happen on a timely basis. And so this is just one more thing we add to our already busy schedule of things that we're doing. So in a nutshell, how is this, our 5% budget going to impact us? We're going to be reducing one person's staff time to about half time. So we're not going to be laying anybody off, which is the good news. But somebody's hours will be reduced. We'll be doing less going to conferences, less educational materials will be developed and use what we have using good old black and white copies and, you know, all that makes sense. But we can't go to some of the conferences where we normally get asked to present because it costs money for us to send somebody. So we are looking to be creative, though, rather than getting on the bandwagon of complaining. We do look at how we can bring in money. We currently are in a large grant with the Department of Human Services, Department of Employment and Economic Development, Pathways to Employment. We're in the last 2 years of that grant, which has been very successful. The double-edged sword here, when we are participating in grants, we have no staff that can really, very little staff, I will say, that can actually help guide and manage the grant. And so now we have our finances and human resources underneath the Department of Admin, the SMART, Small Agency Resource Team. That's helping us immensely, but they too are overstressed. And so it's a double-edged sword, again, when we go out and get grants and bring them in to try to help us. But we are looking to that because we realize we can't be depending totally on state funds as we continue to be stretched with all of our needs and so forth. And looking at council activities with our 15-member board, we meet anywhere between 3 and 4 times a year. We do have an electronic statute, electronic meeting statute in our meeting where we are meeting more via video conference and telephone, which is good. So that's certainly the cost savings, and we're looking to do more of that as well. And then our board would like us to do more outstate travel and have a greater impact on the outstate area. So we're looking to figure out how to do that without looking to more budget to help keep that going. In terms of other streamlined activities, one of the things you'll notice that we are doing very little of is healthcare activities. We work in conjunction with this Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities on that particular issue. We try to collaborate. I seem to be the experts in that area, and so we do look to them for help in the healthcare area because we that is one area that we've seen a reduction in our ability with staffing to be able to work in that issue area. Overall, I would say that, you know, we're at our bare bones minimum right now trying to really keep things going. We haven't really reduced any one particular service other than the healthcare, and that is being done by another community member, which is good. So I think we're able to hold our head above water here and figuring out how to get the job done. And I think the main message here is that even when our budgets are cut, the disability community still looks for us.
We sometimes laugh about on our business card. It says, MISCOD, your technical resource and training, your technical assistance and training resource. We'd like to put on there your last call for help, because we typically, we are their last call, and they call us. And so without us, we often wonder, where would they be? It's not uncommon for us to be getting the calls, I'm going to be kicked out of my house tomorrow, what do I do? Mm-hmm. We'd like to say, could you have called us a week ago? You know, the day before they come to get you is not sufficient. But that's the kind of people that we are dealing with constantly, from Medicare, Social Security, to workers' comp, to housing issues. And we're trying to be there for everyone right now as the budgets get tighter and tighter. But the good news is I've got a great staff. They're willing to keep working together on these issues, and as we're eliminating some hours, it's not wonderful, but at least we're not laying off, anyone. I think right now we're all thankful just to have something versus nothing. So we're a resilient little agency, and we're very relevant to the disability community, and we just want to say thank you for letting us come here today, and if you've got questions, I'll be glad to answer any right now.
Thank you, Ms. Wilshire. Mm-hmm. I think Representative Saylor has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Wilshire, I'll just ask you to perhaps get back to me later in the interest of time, but I was interested when you talked about your teleconferencing and some of the telecommunications. I just would like to, visit a little bit more with you or someone from your group about how those opportunities are working out, where you see problems. How can we work to make the telecommunications part work better for you? If indeed there is a problem, maybe it's all wonderful, but I would just like to visit about that.
There's always, Representative, Madam Chair, and so forth. Absolutely, there's always seem to be some little staff who's working with our Office of Enterprise Technology and then working with the counties, but we've been pretty successful at figuring out how to get things done. Working with our the group who was just here, the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Commission, making sure that our programs are accessible for everybody. So, but I'll certainly get back to you on it, because there are some things that we certainly could use some assistance on.
I have one question myself, and again, it can be a brief answer with maybe more elaboration later, but seems to me with a lot of the veterans returning from the wars, you must have an increased demand. Do you have any specialized services for those folks, or how is that working?
Madam Chair and committee members, last year actually for our awards luncheon, we brought in a speaker to talk about post-traumatic stress and brain injury. And so we certainly, kind of by default, because we're the Council on Disability, get some inquiries. How do we work with people on accommodations going back to work? And so, and that's one of our areas. And discrimination, that is, I kind of overlooked that piece. Discrimination is a huge piece that we do. We get the calls not only from the employee saying, I feel like I'm going to be fired from my job, or from the employer trying to figure out, some instances too, how do I get rid of somebody with a disability or whatever? And so we do get these calls. We do work with the Veterans Board and Administration on this issue and trying to, I think we're kind of like the conduit, trying to figure out how to get people to the right place. We may not always have the answer or expertise, because we are this incredible shrinking little agency, but we usually can figure out where to get you to the right place, and that's the good news. And so, and absolutely, give you the shorter version, we certainly work with them, and it's an important piece because of the brain injury piece. We've got to be working with them. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Committee members, we'll be adjourning in a minute. I believe, Representative Rosenthal, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
I did, ma'am.
Did I
move the minutes?
Okay, so the minutes of March 18th have been moved for adoption. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved and adopted. Members, I just want to say I'm very interested in meeting with any of you who have ideas about how we deal with our target, and I mentioned that to Representative Stevenson. I would certainly be interested in meeting with your caucus and any others on the committee. If you come up with some ideas, I think days like today, where we hear where the need is so deep and our cut is fairly significant too, $16 million. We're interested, I'm interested in your thoughts and ideas, so we can work on this together. So our next meeting will be tomorrow, and until then, the meeting is adjourned.